Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today we'll hear a debate between the two candidates for United States House of Representatives from Nebraska's 2nd Congressional District, incumbent Republican Lee Terry seeking his 8th term in Congress, and challenger Democrat John Ewing, currently Douglas County Treasurer. The debate is co-sponsored by the Omaha Press Club and the League of Women Voters of Greater Omaha. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, October 18, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the candidates and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, the League of Women Voters, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to ask the first question of the candidates is Gary Kerr, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Each candidate will get 1 minute and 30 seconds to respond to each question, plus a 30-second rebuttal. We do have a timer for time cue, so let's begin. And Lee Terry, we are going to begin with you with this first question. How do you see yourself as different from your opponent in this election?
Well, we both went to Northwest High, so that's not it. I was debate team, John was football. After that, meaningful differences for this election. We just have different outviews on what's the right road for this country. For example, I really believe that we have to resolve our spending problem in Washington, D.C., which is why I was part of the task force for the balanced budget amendment that we worked across the aisle, got Democrats to support. It still failed. Voted 157 times to reduce spending. Just in the last 3 years, even voted against several of the Bush-era spending bills and omnibus bills, because I really think controlling spending is a difference. My opponent supported the stimulus package that I thought was wasteful spending. He supports another one. I'm fighting against those type of things. Probably the biggest difference between us is on how what's the right way to do healthcare reforms. The government takeover, the $2 trillion Obamacare bill with 156 new boards and panels and bureaus and 22 new taxes to help raise the money to cover the $2 trillion, that's provided so much uncertainty and worry within the business community and has really been part of the problem. I oppose that. We need to empower doctors and patients to make those type of decisions, not government. So we have a real difference in how this country moves forward. Limited spending, limited government, more spending, higher taxes. Those are the major differences between me and my opponent.
John Ewing.
The difference between Lee Terry and I is simply this. I'm a lifelong public servant of over 30 years in this community. I've worked hard at every level to provide executive leadership, and I believe that's what's missing in Washington when you look at a Congress with a 7% approval rating. You look at the Douglas County Treasurer's Office and what we've been able to do in 5 short years. You look at what I was able to do as a member of the Omaha Police Department. I've helped make your life safer as a member of the Urban Area Security Initiatives effort, which was designed to make sure that we were safe after 9/11 with Homeland Security. We did a great job there for you. I did a great job working with people across party lines with that effort. I've worked across party lines throughout my public service career. As the lieutenant of the Special Victims Unit, I saw things that were going on around this community happening to women and children. Those things happened before I got there, and I was the one who brought the leadership together to help make sure we got those laws passed to protect women and children from some of the horrific things that I was seeing, and I believe that's what is important, someone who will go to Washington and get things done. That's what I've done throughout my career, and that's what I promise you when I go to Washington, D.C.,
Lee Terry, you have 30 seconds.
Yeah, well, it's the legislative branch, not the executive branch, and you have to have a history of working together, and I have that history of being able to move legislation by working together. The XL Keystone Pipeline that was signed into law had Matheson, Democrat. My hydrogen fuel bill had a Democrat. Every bill that I've worked with, I've worked with a Democrat. Even on the balanced budget, we worked with the Blue Dogs to try and get that so that we can get Democratic votes. And because of those type of efforts of continually reaching across the aisle is why I was named one of the top 10 most bipartisan Republicans.
John Ewing, 30 seconds.
It's not a matter of just talking about who you've worked with. It's a matter of what you've gotten done. And the reality is that Lee Terry has a failed legislative record as a member of Congress. What you have to ask yourself is, having a post office named after a pastor, if that's enough to have justified $2.4 million in salary over the last 14 years.
All right, new question. We're going to take this one step further, and we're going to see where this goes. What is your opponent's strongest attribute and your weakest, John Ewing?
Lee Terry's a nice guy. I've known Lee Terry a long time, and this is not personal when I run for Congress against Lee Terry. This was one of the most difficult decisions I've ever made. Lee Terry has tried to serve this community well. I don't believe that he's intentionally at all tried to do anything that would hurt this community. I believe he loves this community just as I do. Probably my weakest attribute is that I'm going to be aggressive to get things done. I make no apologies for working hard. I make no apologies for holding others to a higher standard. I believe that's what you've got to do if you're in leadership, and that's what I've done for the last 30 years, hold people accountable, making sure that I also am accountable for the results. If we don't get results, as I said last night, we might as well shut it down if we're not impacting people's lives, because I don't believe in government for government's sake, and I don't believe in doing things just to say you've done them or to say you have a position. So my goal every day is to impact the lives of the people I serve, and I realize that I work for the people of this community.
Lee Terry, minute 30.
And that's my opponent's strengths and my weakness, right? Is that the question? All right. Yeah, I've known John for a long time, too, and Vivian, his wife. Great people. They're very active in the community. That's something that we teach our kids. We've had my son, who I'm proud to have here today. He's actually served with us down at the Open Door Mission for their Thanksgiving meals. Those are the type of things that we do. That's what John and his family does. And so I'm proud of his record of being on community boards. In fact, Vivian is HR for Habitat for Humanity. Our office does a build with them probably every year I've been in there, and my son helped start up the prep Habitat for Humanity Club. Weaknesses, I probably take things a little too personally, like when John called me a water boy. That really hurt. Still hurts. John called me then and back in high school and just a couple months ago. And so when those things come up, but I want to address real quickly just some of the successes I've had in the last couple years. I drafted a bill for our veterans, for a veteran cemetery here that the Veterans Agency adopted as a rule. So now we have a VA cemetery coming. We were able to fight to get a new VA hospital on the list because of the efforts that I initiated and built a team around. We passed the XL pipeline, got it to the president and several other times, and there's at least another half a dozen successes just in the last 2 years.
John Ewing, you've got 30 seconds.
Okay. I don't have anything to say bad about Lee Terry. As I said earlier, Lee Terry is a guy that I believe has tried to serve this community well. My belief, however, is after 14 years, we need new leadership, and I believe I'm that leadership that will provide the opportunity for us to have great representation in Washington and get things done for this community.
Lee Terry, you got 30 seconds.
Well, I just go on and say that really, starting over, when this is a seniority-based system, I'm finally at the point in my committee with seniority that I could be a subcommittee chair and most likely will. But let's talk about cybersecurity. I was part of the task force that helped write the bill with Mike Rogers. My name's not on it, but every part of it is. There's a variety of other bills. Spectrum bill, the Upton-Walden-Terry bill, where we passed a bill to allow more spectrum for mobility of communications. Those are all important victories.
All right, we got a big bird question.
Ah.
What do you think about federal subsidies for public broadcasting, for example, versus subsidies for other entities like Big Oil, Lee Terry?
Okay. Well, I'm going to start with the Big Oil part, because that seems to be the one that's often brought up. And the reality is I want to reform our corporate tax codes. I want to be able to eliminate all of the specialized winners and tax credits that pick the winners and losers. Let's get rid of all of those. And then we can lower the corporate tax rate so that our businesses can be more competitive. And that's what we want. If we are really focused on growing jobs and growing our economy, and by the way, growing the economy, most people define as growing jobs. That's how I define it. But economists will talk about velocity of dollar. If we are having more transactions, then you have more taxable events that will raise revenues. And frankly, when you look at the three times that presidents have lowered the taxes, if you project just a few years after that, there's increased revenues. So do away with all of those big oil tax breaks as well as others that pick winners and losers. Now, you mentioned Big Bird. If we're going to do both, I have voted. I have a record of saying PBS can stand on its own in today's media world without government subsidies.
John Ewing.
I'll start with Big Bird. I believe that continuing to support public broadcasting is a critical issue. It's such a very small part of our overall federal budget that we really shouldn't be having this conversation about if that's the place to cut. That is not the place to cut. It wouldn't give us any bang for our buck in terms of savings. And more importantly, it would deprive young people of the opportunity and citizens across this country of the opportunity to get that fantastic programming that is available to the citizens of this country and provides valuable information. So I believe we need to continue that small subsidy. When it comes to Big Oil, when it comes to any organization like that that is making billions of dollars in profit, I believe we've got to look very carefully at what we're going to do when it comes to our tax policies. We absolutely need tax reform. If we don't reform our tax code, which hasn't been addressed since 1986, we are going to continue to see these types of things where people abuse the system, people receive subsidies that aren't necessarily needed, and then long term, I believe we've got to look at how we are going to actually diversify our energy so that we can compete internationally and reduce our dependence on foreign oil.
Lee Terry, 30 seconds.
Well, the reason why Big Bird is an issue is it really is a litmus test of how you're going to control spending. If you aren't even able to recognize that PBS can be a standalone cable network or have a UHF station, then the reality is there's nowhere you're going to cut. And so that's why Big Bird is an issue of government spending and whether it's time to let it fly on its own. Now, it's never mind. Stop John, sign.
You can get to that later. John Ewing, you have 30 seconds.
I have made it very clear that I am in favor of making cuts to areas in our budget. What I am not interested in doing, however, is making cuts to say we made a cut. I think you make cuts that have an impact on people's lives, make cuts that will allow us to have a serious discussion on how we're going to move this country forward when we have a $16 trillion debt hanging over our heads and being passed down to future generations.
New question. Congressional gridlock is currently a big problem, as we all know. Every candidate says he or she can work with the other side. Name three congresspersons of the other political side that you most respect and why, John Ewing.
Well, I like our Nebraska delegation. I certainly like Senator Joe Hans. I've worked with him in the past when I was the deputy chief for Homeland Security. I certainly know Jeff Fortenberry and Adrian Smith. So I like the Nebraska folks. I think they've taken those values of Nebraska and taken them to Washington. And I believe that's critically important. I also know a number of members of Congress like Emmanuel Cleaver that I've had the great pleasure of meeting, who's also a Baptist pastor. So we have a little bit in common there. And so I like him as well. So there are a number of people that I've met, that I've worked with in Congress, that I believe are doing the right things for our country, and I'm willing to work across party lines to continue moving us forward rather than the bipartisan or the partisanship that we've seen. This Congress has been declared by the Associated Press the most partisan and least effective Congress in at least a generation. The only way you're going to change Congress is to change the people you send to Congress. And that's why I'm running, because we need to fundamentally change Congress and get people who will work together and get things done. And that's what I've done throughout my public service career for the last 30 years.
Lee Terry, a minute 30.
Well, once again, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle are the ones that named me as one of the top 10 bipartisan people. So specific people that I work with all the time, John Matheson from Utah, Gene Green from Texas, Mike Doyle from Pittsburgh. In fact, a lot of my stuff I work with Mike on. We passed together the hydrogen research bill that really pushes how it was the first time the federal government recognized hydrogen as a transportation fuel. Diane DeGette, probably one of the more liberal people in Congress, she and I worked together on several bills. Anna Eshoo from California, she and I were the co-chairs of the cyber task force from our committee that developed the principles for the bill that was written and passed by the House of Representatives. And by the way, we got that done in a bipartisan way. The Senate wasn't able to. The House of Representatives has done its business, folks. When we look at the fiscal cliff, we've written a bill that resolves the issue on sequestration and protecting our defenses. We passed a bill that would keep the tax code level for the next 14 months through 2014. No raises, no decreases. We thought that was the middle ground, and we get everyone's support. Again, we passed that in the House. It went to the Senate. It didn't do it. We've had 1,900 votes, third most in House history. But you need to look at the Senate and their 300 votes.
John Ewing, 30 seconds.
Mr. Terry mentioned the fiscal cliff. The reality is Congress left Washington to come back to campaign for their jobs while leaving this country in doubt about our future and what we could expect. What most of you may not know is people on October 1st had to begin worrying about their jobs because they didn't know if the government was going to be funded.
Lee Terry.
Yeah, and it's frustrating to me that we're waiting till the lame duck to do this. I hate kicking the can down the road. That's why in July we tried to resolve these issues. We've asked them to come to the table. We're sitting at the table. The Senate left. The president's out campaigning. I'd go back tomorrow if they said, we're going to be earnest and sit down and resolve these issues. I'd be on a plane tonight.
New question. Name a specific position, if you can, in your party's platform that you cannot support, Lee Terry.
Oh, I wish you wouldn't have asked that because I haven't read the platform. I think platforms are great projects for our where we nominate our presidents, candidates, the conventions. My goodness, I'm sorry. Too many cups of coffee today. But I haven't read that, so I really can't earnestly say what parts of it I would disagree with since I haven't read that. But I do believe when it comes down to it, every representative in Congress, including me, is a representative of the district that they live in, grew up in. And there's probably not one person on either side that's going to be 100% beholden to that party platform.
John Ewing, any position you can't support?
I'll talk about one where they didn't put it in and then apparently decided to put it in at the last moment. I don't believe that the Democratic Party should have left God out of their platform. To me, that was a mistake that I would not support and don't believe that it should ever be out of a platform for any major political party in this country. So that is the one that I disagree with and would say don't ever do it again, because that's the essence of who I am. And we may disagree on issues as Democrats and Republicans, but I believe that is the essence of who I am and would not support any effort to do that in the future.
Lee Terry, you want to pick up on this for 30 seconds?
Well, I agree with that comment that I thought that was horrible that they would leave God out and that God got booed at the convention. But one of the areas that I think is starkly different between the two is probably on the life position. And I even say in my own bio that I'm pro-life. And I believe as a basic tenet of a moral society that you protect the lives of the most vulnerable, and one of the most vulnerable out there is the unborn.
John Ewing.
Once again, I just would stick with what I've said already, because it was just so important to me when I saw that I could not in good conscience support that, and I'm glad they made the change. I don't know that God was booed at the convention, however.
Yeah. New question. What should be our energy policy? Should the focus be on alternative forms of energy, wind, solar, and so forth? Or should we focus on developing new sources of oil, John Ewing?
I believe we have to have a short-term, mid-range plan and a long-term plan. We certainly have to make sure that we are doing everything we can today to continue to find more oil here in the continental United States, because I believe that's critical for our long-term success as well. We also have to begin to look at things like alternative energy such as wind. I've said this before, Nebraska is the fourth windiest state in the country, and we need to be looking at, and I saw an article where Nebraska Public Power is going to be doing this, but we need to make sure that we are focusing on working with Nebraska Public Power, OPPD, MUD, and others to have an opportunity on the federal level to take advantage of that energy opportunity. I also believe we need to be looking long term and looking at renewable fuel as well. We've got to begin to look at alternative energy sources that we can produce so that we are not dependent on foreign oil, so we are not held hostage by the international conflicts that come up and create an inability for us to count on reasonably priced energy for business and for the citizens of this country.
Lee Terry, a minute 30.
Thank you. I think energy security and energy independence is one of the key tenets, pillars of our future. If we aren't in control of our own energy, we will not be in control of our economy. We send nearly $1 billion a day to OPEC countries, many of which don't like us, when we can be energy independent. That's one of the reasons I fought to get on the Energy Committee, which is why I've been such a proponent of the Keystone Pipeline, of natural gas as transportation, have a geothermal bill that passed that Mr. Ewing didn't recognize, the hydrogen for transportation, and several other legislative successes involved in two major energy bills. Not to say that also my CAFE bill, the Hill-Terry bill that became law. We negotiated, as every major bill is done. But there's no doubt that it was my bill that was the boilerplate that got this done. We have to think of energy as two rails of the same track. We talked about transportation. We need to move to more alternative fuels like biofuels, hydrogen, and others, but electrical generation is the other part. And for electrical generation, we need to have clean coal technologies, and there's been a bunch of rules put out that will just close coal-fired plants, and the technologies don't even exist. And we've spent a year and a half in our committee exposing how those rules will shut down coal, but coal and clean coal technology has to be part of the overall portfolio.
John Ewing, 30 seconds.
I'm not going to discuss for you all today whether or not Hill-Terry became law. I would just suggest that you read the Omaha World Herald editorial and the endorsement of my candidacy, and then you can make your decision on whether or not that bill died in committee. The thing that we have to do is we have to work across party lines, get people recognizing that this is a long-term problem that we're facing, and we cannot continue down the road that we're on.
Lee Terry?
May I direct your attention to the World Herald's fact-checking? The World Herald reporter was intimately involved in the entire process of Hill-Terry Bill, and that's why they said in their fact-checking, John, that your position was not accurate, that Hill-Terry was the boilerplate that was used. The person, Democrat, that was in charge of that bill, John Dingell, which is another guy I really respect and like, said on the floor when the bill was passing that it was the Hill-Terry bill. It was it, and you can't change reality.
New question. Do you believe in global warming? And if so, should our energy policy reflect a need to address it, Lee Terry?
Global warming, or climate change as the term is now. I think every scientist that's been before our committee, the Energy and Commerce Committee, has said, the climate is changing. Most have said it's warming. There's now some that are saying it's cooling. The Arctic is melting. The Antarctic is growing. All I know is the issue is really what is the anthropological, is there an anthropological impact? Is man causing this? That's the ultimate answer, because if man is impacting it, then you're going to say, we need to just cut off all fossil fuels, let's run our economy off the cliff, let's be non-competitive with the rest of the world, then the Waxman-Pelosi position makes sense. I don't know, because frankly, the scientists on the impact of man are pretty split. But I do agree that if we can use coal and make it cleaner, if we can reduce our emissions, we should be doing it. That's why I supported a CAFE bill in clean coal technologies to reduce our emissions and our impact. Because if we have that, let's be responsible. But I'm not going to close down every coal-fired plant, put demands on them that they can never operate again, that you have to go to alternatives, but you can't use nuclear. These are the type of things that frustrate me, because I don't think they're common sense, reasonable positions.
John Ewing.
I believe that there is global warming that is happening. The question becomes, how do we begin to address it? I would never suggest that we stop all coal usage, that we cut out fossil fuels. That is not obviously the way to address it. But what we have to do, just like I talked about with my long-term energy plan, is to begin to reduce dependency on oil, begin to reduce dependency on coal, and look at how we can have alternatives that are cleaner and have a less of an impact on our environment. Anyone who doesn't think global warming is occurring can disagree with most of the scientists. The problem becomes, if you're wrong and we continue down this path, we're in deep trouble. I think we've got to listen to the scientists. We've got to do the right things in terms of reducing our emissions, looking at more efficient energy for cars like electric hybrid cars, all of those types of things, as well as the factories and other business environments, making sure that we are working with them, not against them, as we make this transition, because we have to make it.
Lee Terry, 32nd.
Well, I'm not for unilateral disarmament. I don't want to empower China any more than we have. They'll certainly buy all of the oil that will be left behind that we won't use in an environmentally responsible way. A couple weeks ago, I did a natural gas forum, brought in people from all around the country. Natural gas is a cleaner burning fuel, and I'm working to move it into transportation, working with fleets, truckers. That's an area that we can really be effective with federal policy and use those type of resources that'll be cleaner.
John Ewing.
I'll remind people just very quickly of the Hill-Terry bill. One of the provisions in that bill was an attempt to keep the federal government from ever being able to have standards higher than 35 miles per gallon. And so you have someone working against energy efficiency that would have cost us 700,000 barrels of oil imports per day if the lesser standards had been approved.
Well, that's just another lie, John. Can I have that's
all
an
right,
attack.
We'll give you 30, and then we're going to give John 30.
All
okay,
right.
Go ahead.
The bill was from current to 2022, a build up to 35 miles per gallon. 35. It started at 31 to 35. We negotiated to a solid 35. That's not ever, and you got to realize to design cars, it takes a little bit of time. So you go through the out years. You've got to realize the engineering and the manufacturing processes that have to go into that. But saying ever is just plain wrong.
John, you got 30 seconds to respond.
Mr. Terry supported a bill that would have lowered the CAFE standards and kept them at 32 and not allowed them to go higher than 35. If the technology was available, it would have prevented the federal government from doing it as well as the individual states. That is what the concerned scientists, the Union of Concerned Scientists, were upset about when they looked at his television ad.
All right, new question. Earmarks. There is currently a moratorium on the use of congressional earmarks for special projects, but it will almost certainly resurface. Would you support a bill restricting the addition of earmarks to other bills in favor of one earmark bill per session, which would include everyone's earmarks? What do you think about that, John Ewing?
I would certainly support not having earmarks attached to other pieces of legislation. One of the things I believe that has happened in Congress is that the legislation has become convoluted and not straightforward, and you have things being attached to legislation that doesn't have anything to do with that particular area of legislation. That's part of the problem. That's why it's so difficult to get things done back in Washington. I believe what you've got to do is look at this process much more clearly and transparently, making sure everyone knows what is going to be put in any district and spent, whether you call it an earmark or you call it something else. We've got to make that process much, much, much more transparent to the citizens of America rather than having them attached to bills at the end and no one really knows what they just signed. No one really knows what they just spent money on, and then we continue to watch our deficits and our long-term debt grow. We've got to keep that process from ever getting out of control like it was in the past.
Lee Terry, minute 30.
Well, it's a great question and one that I did a few earmarks here and there when I was there, and I voted to actually end earmarks. And here's why. I thought it became a really corrupt procedure in two different ways. If you look how the money was used for earmarks, in which people who say earmarks is such, it's such a fraction of the overall budget. It's not even 1% when you add up all the earmarks. But the issue is how they were done. First of all, if you were on the Appropriations Committee, you got all of the money, or most of it. And so what became just a committee where you just benefited your own self and your districts that sit like lobster museums, for God's sakes. So they weren't even in the national interests. And it has to be in the national interest. The other part about it is a lot of these were being dropped in. We called it airdropping at the conferences. So you'd pass a clean appropriation bill, then all of a sudden it goes to conference with the Senate, and everyone starts putting these earmarks in there by airdropping them, and then you have no opportunity to vet them. So if they would ever return, they have to be transparent. They have to be voted on in the committees, subcommittees, committees, and they have to be a process where we can vote on them in the House of Representatives or the Senate floor to eliminate them.
John Ewing, 30 seconds.
The only thing I would add to my answer is this. I believe they also would need to be voted on individually, so you could have the opportunity to take out some of the earmarks or, once again, whatever the term is. So they are actually going to be things that everybody looks at, everybody knows what they're voting for, and we don't have a situation where you just pass one large bill of earmarks and people aren't aware of what's actually in that particular bill.
Lee Terry, you want to pick up?
Yeah, that's the way, and that's why I voted against that, was to be able to clean up that process. It needed to be done, and they have to be voted on. And just to add a little bit of context, I voted when they were brought up, and you did have an amendment to withdraw something like the Lobster Museum. I was voting with those to be able to pull that out. And there was like 80 of us that were actually voting to pull those things out. So the reality is we need a lot more discipline in Congress if we're going to do it. But I'm proud that I was voting against those or for those amendments to pull the earmarks out.
How much should the federal government be involved with local education on issues like standardized testing in all subjects, and with regard to such things as vouchers and privatization, Lee Terry?
Well, obviously, I want every one of our children in the metropolitan area to succeed, and to be successful, they have to have great education. There's no doubt about it. My wife and I are both OPS. I mentioned I went to Northwest. Robin's an Eagle, always brags about that. And we need to make our public institutions as strong as they can be. I voted for No Child Left Behind. I also wrote the bill 2 years later that would undo a lot of the No Child Left Behind mandates that just weren't reasonable. But I have because of that experience with No Child Left Behind and what we're seeing now with the Race to the Top rules and regulations being put in by the Department of Education, I believe we're going the wrong way with education. More and more is being dictated by Washington, D.C. The only way that we're going to have strong education is to empower it locally. There's two people that are necessary to make it strong. It's the teacher in the classroom, which I'm proud that most of the teachers we've ever had I thought were awesome for my kids. But parents have to be involved. And if the educational decisions are made in Washington, D.C., you're disenfranchising the parent from being involved. If we don't have parents involved in the process, our educational systems will continue to devolve, not John, get better.
John Ewing, a minute 30.
I'm a strong supporter of public schools. I'm a graduate of Omaha Northwest High School, as you know. My wife is also a graduate of Omaha Central High School. What we believe is that No Child Left Behind has been an abysmal failure. What you get is 10% of the funding and 90% of the rules being pushed down to the local school districts. I believe what we ought to be doing is working with our teachers in the classroom to make sure they have access to great training. If you look at all of the studies that have been done, the thing you'll find is that when we invest in teachers, when we give them an in-depth knowledge of the subject matters that they are teaching, their students perform better. I also believe that standardized testing and things like that also need to be pushed to either the state or the local level, not being dictated by the federal government. And we need to quit doing as much teaching to the test and preparing young people to take a test as we can, and look at things like sampling of students, which is done around the world successfully in countries that are having more academic success than the United States. So we need to look at what's going on around the world and make sure that we're implementing best practices.
Lee Terry, 30 seconds.
Well, I appreciate that John agrees with my position that local is better. And I'm concerned about the race to the top, because this is going around Congress. If you talk to superintendents, the State Board of Education, they're very frustrated because Nebraska can't meet a lot of those standards that are being mandated on our school districts right now. I'd also give a quick story about a teacher I met with at one of our inner city schools, principal, who on a child that needed it would bring them in and sit down and clearly express to the parent what their role would be. They became a blue ribbon school.
John Ewing.
I will just tell you, not a story, but about some of the work that I've been involved in Omaha. We have a group now called Communities in Schools, where we've been able to have a program where they go into the schools and meet the basic needs of the students, helping them if they need a winter coat, helping them if they need an alarm clock, and all of those things to help them get to school on time so that they can be successful academically. And so those are the types of things I believe we need to do as we're looking at supporting our school systems.
New question. Student debt has reached a staggering $1 trillion, while major universities accumulate billions of dollars in tax-exempt endowments. Would you consider changing the tax-exempt status to promote the use of more of those funds for student tuition, John Ewing?
I would not support taking away a tax exemption for these universities. I believe what we need to do is figure out how we are going to help our students not accumulate the debt. And one of the people I talked to during this campaign was a father who had a daughter who was finishing medical school. She wanted to be an emergency room doctor. And she was going to be $400,000 in debt because of student loans. I believe what we've got to do is make sure that we're trying to find a way to either forgive or give a forbearance for people who go into some of the professions where our country has a dire need, so that we reduce the amount of debt that they owe. We also have to keep student loans affordable. We also have to make sure our young people understand the value of our community colleges and our trade schools, and look at the other options, as well as making sure that we increase Pell Grants. I went to college the first 2 years because of Pell Grants, and at that time it paid most of my tuition. Today, at $5,500, it pays less than half of the tuition for a year at a public university.
Lee Terry?
Thank you. And obviously, college level is necessary. We're a country that is one of the most ingenious, inventive cultures in the world, history of the world. And it has a lot to do with our higher education. And like John, both of us from Northwest High, I didn't have money to go to college. I did it by working three jobs, student loans, and yes, even a Pell Grant, John. Then I married Robin. Single family. Mom was a secretary. That was my dowry, was her student loans. Now, your question was about a tax policy issue that is in the realm of the federal government. And the answer to your question is no, I wouldn't support that. Because what you're doing then is using your tax policy as a weapon. Your tax policy shouldn't be picking winners and losers. Educational institutions are 501c3s. So now all of a sudden you're going to change your tax policy to say, depending on the amount of endowment money you've raised from your alumni, depends on your tax status. That is a really dangerous policy path to go down. I am going to express one frustration in my 13 seconds left in my answer. Mm-hmm. I voted to increase Pell Grants, and I have voted to increase the amounts of student loans. But it seems like every year we do that, universities increase their tuitions more than that. It's frustrating that we can never catch up with the university inflation.
John Ewing, 30 seconds.
I think I made it clear, but just in case I didn't, I would not endorse changing the tax-exempt status of our universities. That is the wrong approach to take to this issue. I believe we need to be partnering with them rather than dictating to them, and as Lee said, using our tax policy as some type of weapon. Let's build cooperative efforts working with the universities and colleges to make sure that they understand the importance of keeping tuition affordable.
Lee, you want to add?
The issue really does come down to how do we make tuition affordable? And I think we disguise that issue when the answer is always just Congress raised the amount of student loans and Pell Grants, because that just seems to be a license to increase it. Sorry, Jim, at Metro, but you've actually been pretty dang good about it at Metro, and you've made yourself affordable. And more people, even in our neighborhood, are going to Metro before they'll go to a regular university. I think that's a pretty smart play.
New question. There is general agreement that lax regulation was a major contributor to the recession we are hopefully emerging from. Yet in some quarters, there are calls for even less regulation. What is your position on the question of the kind of federal government regulation we are talking about, Lee Terry?
Well, generally speaking, on rules and regulations, yes, we need them. Just like there has rules in football and a referee to enforce them. Now they're being enforced at a little higher level. Now, I want to talk. I think you're talking about what would be the Dodd-Frank bill on Wall Street. Because what my frustration was when I was reading through that bill and studying it is that it seemed to apply to everyone, but was a glancing blow to Wall Street. When we talked about exotics like wrapping mortgages into securitized portfolios and then doing double credit swaps, that was unregulated. That's why they did those type of things, is because they were outside of the SEC's purview. We needed to regulate those. But go and talk to a local banker. The local banker will tell you that they are the ones that are bearing the burden of that bill. It is hitting Main Street much more than it's hitting Wall Street. Wall Street's doing fine. You walk into a bank for a loan, you're going to have a tough time getting it today. Much to do because of Dodd-Frank's rules and regulations and clamping down. So you go in and even do a refi, you may be one of the richest people and you're going to have to present documentation out the gazoo because of Dodd-Frank. It went too far.
John Ewing.
I believe what should be happening at the federal level is that government should be working with business. One of the things I've said throughout this campaign as I've listened and talked to business people is we need to do it like we've done it in the Douglas County Treasurer's Office. When I went there, we had so many rules that I couldn't even keep them straight. And so I put together a policy review committee that actually looked at the rules that we had in place, looked at which ones were necessary to have complete cooperation and understanding within our organization on how we were going to carry out our duties, making sure we were consistent across the then 6 customer service centers, and then getting rid of the ones that didn't work. We got rid of about 2/3 of the rules in that organization. And I think you all would agree that they now understand what is expected of them and do a great job for the citizens of this community. That's what we need to do with this type of legislation as well. Working with business owners, making sure that they are part of the solution. I've talked to local bankers as well, and they do not believe that this legislation should have been pushed down to them. And I have to tell you that I agree. This did not do what it was supposed to do. And I think what we need to do is always be willing, when something doesn't work as it's supposed to, make the changes necessary to make it work the way it's supposed to work.
Lee Terry, 30 seconds.
I wish it was that simple. There have been business people by the thousands that have gone to D.C. and complained about the overregulation on their institutions. That's been deftly, or been, well, let's just say Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi have flatly said there's going to be no changes to Dodd-Frank. It takes a lot more of an effort than just bringing a couple of business people over there to talk. And frankly, I talk to business people all the time, and they're frustrated with regulations at a lot of different levels.
John Ewing?
The problem with Congress is they haven't included business in the development of the legislation from the beginning. And that's what I'm talking about here. I'm not talking about just looking at the legislation after it's already in place. But I believe you should be involved in the process from the very beginning, because we want regulation that limits our exposure, limits the risk to our economy, but it can never be used to keep us from growing our economy and employing people.
Last question. We're almost down to the end. Many experts believe that at least some cuts in benefits has to be part of the answer to keeping Social Security and Medicare solvent over the long term. Name two ideas to handle this potential insolvency, and please take a look at cuts as closely as you can. Ewing? John Ewing?
I believe one of the things we have to do is make sure we keep Social Security strong and vibrant and keep our promises to the citizens of this country. I believe we've got to look at how we are going to do that. One of the ways I believe we can do that is by raising the cap on Social Security wages, as well as looking at how far we need to raise that and making sure we have the right balance, because all of tax policy should be about balance. The other part of that is, as we look at this, we may have to make some changes. We may have to raise the age to 70 or 67. We may have to look at means testing. I don't have all of the answers for those things, and I'm not going to tell you that I do. But what I will do is listen to groups like the AARP and others who have suggestions. They have booklets with 13 or 14 principles for Medicare and Social Security. And I believe that's what a member of Congress should be doing, is listening to the experts. So I will do that. I don't believe we need to do that today, however. I believe we need to continue to look at how we're going to strengthen it for the future.
Lee Terry.
Well, there's no more solemn a promise than there is to our seniors on Medicare and Social Security, period. I won't allow Medicare to be changed for our seniors. But we have to realize, as the future goes, 10,000 new people a day going in, that when we look forward 10, 20 years from now, it's going to go bankrupt. And if it goes bankrupt, what happens is that reimbursements to physicians and hospitals are cut, which will limit seniors' access. That will be a cut in benefits. Social Security is good till 2033. Simple solutions like increasing it to I'm 67 for retirement to 68, 69. Those are things that we're going to have to look at. Those are solid ways of doing it. Your question was how to do this. So raising the age for Medicare, maybe from me, I'm 50, to 66 or 66 and a half will help keep it solvent much longer. We need to manage it where it's not managed by like the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which is in Obamacare, that would just say that government makes decisions of not paying bills, therefore eliminating it, or by taking $716 billion out of Medicare and shifting it to a health insurance program for those under 65. That's not the way to help Medicare.
Thank you, gentlemen. We're so close to the end here that I'm going to cut off our 30-second responses and go to closing statements. And each candidate will now get a two-minute closing statement. And with a coin toss, we have determined that, Lee Terry, you go first.
Well, thank you. And the reality is that this is a historic election. And a lot of people are frustrated with the direction of our country. I have been out in the community. I've met with hundreds of business people, one of them here today, that started a company with $75. Or was it $75 or $25? Either way, he started it, and he's got now 8 employees. But when I sat down and talked to him, he said, look, I don't know what you guys are doing to me. You're telling me you're going to raise taxes on me, which means I don't know if I should hire or not. Because if you make me pay more taxes, I may not be able to afford. So we have to realize that tax policies have consequences on job creation and the economy. So that's why I voted to hold the line on our tax policy while we can reform it. My opponent wants to raise taxes, although millionaires or $250,000 wage earners as a family, I don't know what it is. I just know that he wants to raise taxes. Then we talk about spending. Spending has to get under control. When I'm out knocking on doors, that's the most often complaint is the government spending. And I'm proud of my record of trying to get government spending under control and limiting government. Now, one last thing. If we want jobs created now, let's start using our own natural resources. We have a glut of natural gas. We have new finds of oil. We can do it in an environmentally sensitive way. Let's stop sending $1 billion overseas, start investing that in our own economy, and grow jobs. Thank
John
you.
John Ewing, 2 minutes.
This election is historic, as Lee said. The question really becomes, do you want someone that you've seen provide quality leadership throughout this community for the last 30 years with the Omaha Police Department, where I worked to make sure that women and children were safe, where I worked as a deputy chief on Homeland Security to keep Washington, Douglas, and Sarpy County safe, where I worked as a deputy chief also to make sure we kept the entire state of Nebraska safe, working with the governor, lieutenant governor, and law enforcement across the state of Nebraska. The other thing that I've done as your Douglas County treasurer is cut the growth of government. We've got to cut the growth of government and cut spending and reduce unnecessary programs. We've got to do that in order to make sure that we keep the programs that are working well for the citizens. There are things that we can cut before we cut Social Security, before we cut Medicare, that would allow us to be able to keep our promise to our seniors. There's an opportunity here for you to vote for someone that you can trust to provide that type of leadership. There's an opportunity here for you to trust someone who's shown you through 30 very public years of public service a better way. There has got to be a better way when you have a Congress that has a 7% approval rating. They aren't getting the job done. And the only way you change that is by sending new people to Washington to work for you.
Well, that concludes our debate. A big thank you to the candidate.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. We've heard a debate between the two candidates for House of Representatives from Nebraska's 2nd Congressional District, incumbent Republican Lee Terry seeking his 8th term in Congress, and challenger Democrat John Ewing, currently Douglas County Treasurer. The debate was co-sponsored by the Omaha Press Club and the League of Women Voters of Greater Omaha. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, October 18, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. If you'd like to attend future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.